to the continued expansion of the Alberta tar, of the Alberta tar sands in our backyard. But when it comes down to leadership, our leadership has been coerced. They, through bribery, through coercion by the government, coercion by the companies themselves to make deals. And what we're looking to do in this region, rather than look for the consent of Indigenous communities, is we're looking for what it's going to take monetarily to get communities to finally buckle under the pressure, the financial pressures that exist within our territories. So as far as the debate goes, it's really, really mixed. People don't know what to do anymore. They feel really locked into this economy, and they feel forced to make decisions that they don't necessarily agree with. And we're not really being given any other options. Like we're hearing about Line 3 in the region here, they're saying that we need these pipelines in order to make transportation of oil safer. It's one or the other, not a good decision for our communities to be making.
We want to thank you both for being with us. We're going to do part two and post online at democracynow.org. Ariel Deranger speaking to us from Alberta, Indigenous Climate Action, Winona LaDuke, Native American activists with Honor the Earth. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
Your investment in community radio can go on with a planned gift to KBOO. Consider adding KBOO to your will, or add KBOO as a beneficiary to your insurance and bank accounts. You can change your mind anytime if your circumstances change. But recognizing KBOO along with your family and friends in your legacy giving is a powerful commitment to media justice. Let us know if you add KBOO to your plans. We'd like to thank you for your considerate future gift. Contact us at 503-231-8032 or email development@kboo.fm to notify us of your plans.
The time is 5:02 p.m. on September 4th, 2018. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Levin & Levine, LLP, attorneys specializing in personal injury law. Levin & Levine offices are located in Southeast Portland and Old Town Sherwood. More information available by phone at 503-946-8708 and online at levinandlevine.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, International Paper has been fined by Oregon regulators after an oil spill.
Corvallis police are evicting people from a homeless camp on the Willamette River.
And in international news, Typhoon Jebi made landfall in Japan.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 4th, 2018. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund.
And I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. International Paper has been fined over $20,000 by Oregon regulators after an oil spill in March that affected the Mackenzie River. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality said that a hydraulic line broke at a company facility on March 13th and released 1,000 gallons of oil into the river. International Paper took more than 5 hours to report the spill, which the state argues delayed the cleanup. In a written statement, the manager of International Paper's Springfield Mill, Doug Black, said, quote, We apologize for this incident, and systems have been put in place to prevent it from happening again. The Department of Environmental Quality fined International Paper $6,400 for the reporting delay and $14,400 for the oil spill.
Last Friday, Corvallis police began evicting people from a large camp of unhoused people on the east bank of the Willamette River. The camp is located in the Orleans Natural Area, which is across the river from downtown Corvallis. The difference between this eviction and so many others in the Portland area is that the police and social workers have been coming to the area for the past 90 days, talking to the 50 to 60 people living there and giving advanced warning of the impending action. Also on the scene Friday were workers for Corvallis Housing First, which is one of several nonprofit and government agencies which comprise the Street Outreach and Response Team, or SORT. The mission of SORT is to provide food, water, and clothing to houseless people, as well as helping to make connections to other services that could help them get off the streets. Even though the notices given on Friday stated the occupants had 24 hours to leave, they have been assured by the police that there will be a grace period and that they actually will have until September 11th to vacate. At that time, crews from Corvallis Parks and Recreation and the Oregon Department of Transportation will come and dispose of any garbage left in the area. Any personal belongings left behind will be stored for 30 days.
A typhoon that made landfall in western Japan has caused extensive damage and led to multiple deaths. At least six people have died, according to Japan's public broadcaster, NHK. Thousands of people are stranded at the Kansai International Airport after flooding damaged the bridge leading to the airport. Based on wind speeds, Typhoon Jebi was classified, quote, very strong, by Japan's weather agency. Jebi had wind speeds over 100 miles per hour. The last typhoon with the same classification that made landfall in Japan was in 1993. The storm hit Shikoku Island around noon local time on Tuesday. It then moved across Japan's largest main island of Honshu. More than 1.6 million people lost power in the storm, and some parts of central and western Japan are still under evacuation advisories. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe called on people to, quote, take action to protect your lives, including preparing and evacuating early. Japan's weather agency has also warned of possible landslides, flooding, high tides, lightning, and violent winds in the affected areas.
The Mississippi cities of Gulfport, Long Beach, and Biloxi have received mandatory evacuation orders for their harbors and marinas. Additionally, the U.S. Coast Guard has temporarily closed the port of New Orleans along with the ports of Mobile, Alabama, and Pascagoula, Mississippi, to prepare for the landfall of Tropical Storm Gordon. The National Weather Service has issued a hurricane warning from the Mississippi-Louisiana border to the Alabama-Florida border, and all schools in the affected area have been closed. Governor Phil Bryant of Mississippi said at a news conference this afternoon that the storm is expected to make landfall around 8 p.m. Central Time near Long Beach, which is located just west of Gulfport on the Gulf Coast. Hurricane Gordon is expected to weaken after it comes inland, though cities along the coast can expect anywhere from 4 to 7 inches of rain, with higher amounts in some areas.
And now, from the Yale Center for Environmental Communication, it's Climate Connections. On today's episode, flooding affects a lab where scientists study floods.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. For scientists at a marine lab in Louisiana, coastal flooding is more than just a research topic. It's a frequent reality. Dozens of times a year, getting to work means pulling on rubber boots and trudging through a flooded parking lot.
If flooding is a little bit heavier than that, some people park near the highway where it's out of the water and will use four-wheel drive vehicles to get people in and out of the lab.
Craig McLean directs the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium. The research lab sits on a thin strip of land southwest of New Orleans.
We're about as far south in Louisiana as you can go.
It's a region that's rapidly losing land, partly because the ground itself is sinking and eroding. This leaves homes and buildings vulnerable to flooding. And as sea levels rise, the threats are growing. McLean says the lab may eventually need to relocate, but they're staying put as long as possible.
Our location here is very, very important to us.
He says it helps scientists empathize with people whose homes, livelihoods, and communities are at risk.
It's not, oh, there's coastal loss somewhere. It's like, oh, there's coastal loss here, and I can see it, you know, and experience it and witness it myself.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
CurrentCast is a daily podcast that highlights issues affecting one of our most precious resources, fresh water. On today's episode, we'll learn about toothy salamanders that can be found at the bottom of lakes and rivers.
A puppy with two rows of teeth on this CurrentCast. Say hello to the mud puppy. This splotchy brown salamander with its red feathery gills can be found at the bottom of lakes, rivers, and ponds across eastern North America. It can grow to more than a foot and prowls about at night, sniffing out tasty snacks like crayfish, worms, or insects. Mud puppy eggs and hatchlings are susceptible to predators, but adults are tougher to catch. That's thanks to glands that secrete a slimy protective poison and sense organs that alert them to passing ne'er-do-wells like large fish, turtles, water snakes, and herons. But it's the mud puppy's habit of chomping down on the bait at the end of a fishing line that makes humans their biggest predator. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more at CurrentCast.org.
Next up, it's the Week in Water from H2O Radio.
Batteries are causing a water crisis. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
It's back to school time, but in Detroit, if kids and teachers get thirsty, they will be drinking bottled water. That's because after testing 24 schools, 16 were found to contain lead or copper. Drinking water has now been shut off in all Detroit public schools.
The Detroit Free Press reports that officials have been attempting to assure residents that the problem has to do with the school's plumbing and not the water supply. Washing hands and flushing toilets will still be allowed.
Detroit's not alone. Lead was recently found in schools in Hammond, Indiana, and Polk County, Florida.
In July, the Federal Government Accounting Office released data showing that testing for lead is done in only 43% of the nation's school districts, and nearly 4 in 10 of those had elevated lead levels.
Batteries are increasingly a part of our lives. They're in our cell phones, laptops, and now electric cars. Most contain lithium, and much of it, nearly 50%, is mined from one of the driest places on Earth, the Atacama Desert in Chile.
As reported in Wired, to extract lithium, miners start by drilling a hole in salt flats and then pump mineral-rich brine to the surface. After waters evaporate, the lithium is collected. The process is relatively cheap, but it uses a lot of water, about 500,000 gallons per ton of lithium. And that's having a big effect on local farmers and ranchers, some of whom have had to get water driven in from elsewhere.
In May, the government released a study showing that the country's rivers, aquifers, glaciers, and lakes are shrinking in the midst of a long-term drought. And as Reuters reports, that has local indigenous peoples, copper miners, and lithium extraction companies all competing for water.
Efforts to conserve have been difficult because one agency regulates the mining of metals, but another regulates brine and water pumping, and there's been no communication between the two.
However, about 10 days ago, the Chilean government announced that water permits in the south part of the Atacama Desert would be limited because the current situation is not sustainable.
There's another unsustainable practice, the dredging of sand, and it's seriously harming some poor countries.
Sand and gravel are the most extracted materials in the world after water. They are used in construction for concrete and asphalt. Countries like Singapore have used sand to make its land mass larger, and that island nation has grown by a fifth since 1965.
Much of the sand is being extracted from Cambodia and Indonesia. According to a new study from researchers at the University of Ottawa, the dredging of coastal sand is causing the loss of mangrove swamps, coastal erosion, and damaging local fishing, particularly in Cambodia.
According to The Guardian, the research shows that sand miners have destroyed at least 24 islands in Indonesia in the last 13 years.
Coastal sand is much more suited for construction than that from the desert. The desert winds make the grains too round. China is one of the largest consumers of sand. Between 2011 and 2013, it used more sand than the U.S. did in the entire 20th century.
Shipping through the Arctic Ocean may become easier with the melting ice due to global warming. The number of ships traveling there is increasing and expected to grow.
Some of those ships are operated by cruise lines, and a new study commissioned by the World Wildlife Fund Canada shows that the amount of gray water from sinks, laundry machines, bathtubs, shower stalls, or dishwashers that's dumped into the ocean could double by 2035.
Currently, there are no regulations about disposal in northern Canada. The ships discharge it without any treatment. Melissa Nock of the Wildlife Fund told the Toronto Star that it contains detergents, shampoos, microplastics, food particles, oils, grease, and metals.
Nock said that all of the cleaning materials on ships is pretty toxic stuff, and it can create dead zones due to algal blooms and can also contaminate shellfish. The gray water affects the food chain from invertebrates to whales.
However, cruise ships that go through Alaska are more regulated by both that state and the U.S. government, so some ships bypass Alaska to dump their waste in Canadian waters.
Besides gray water dumping, environmentalists worry that a shipwreck could leak heavy oil into the seas where cold temperatures slow or halt its breakdown. And finally this week, it's been a hot, dry summer in much of Europe. Drought and searing heat waves have led to wildfires in Sweden and Germany, and many farmers are struggling to produce crops.
The low rainfall has dropped water levels so much that in some places, ancient sites have been revealed. The Smithsonian reports that an ornate 17th century garden in England and a prehistoric henge in Ireland have emerged, as well as a lost German village once submerged underwater.
The drought has also revealed something more ominous. Hunger stones.
Hunger stones are big boulders that were embedded in rivers, mostly around Germany in the 15th through 19th centuries. They were meant to mark the water level as a warning to future generations about potential bad harvests and famine should the water level sink that low again.
And with the severe conditions this summer, more than a dozen hunger stones are now visible along the Elbe River in the Czech Republic. According to Reuters, a boulder in Děčín dating from 1616 is fully exposed after the river level dropped to 45 inches.
Known as Hunger Rock, it contains an inscription which translates to, "If you see me, weep."
While the rocks and their carvings may chronicle historic weather patterns, their appearances may now be a tool for scientists to study climate change.
The Guardian reports that the European Drought Observatory recommends that farmers take steps to adapt to warmer climates with crop adaptation and more sustainable watering practices.
Here's hoping that no stone is left unturned toward reducing the impacts of climate change. This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, highlighting the latest cost-effective strategies to manage aging infrastructure at the Water Infrastructure Conference and Expo, October 28th to 31st in Atlanta. Learn more at awwa.org/H2O Infocon.
Seventy-eight elephant corpses have been found near a protected sanctuary in Botswana. All the animals were killed and stripped for their tusks. The elephants were discovered by Elephants Without Borders, a conservation nonprofit organization. The elephants were killed near the Okavango Delta Wildlife Sanctuary. Botswana has the largest elephant population in the world. However, between 2007 and 2014, the number of elephants in Africa in total declined by 30%. Although there is a ban on legal sales, ivory demand is still high, high enough to sustain underground black markets.
Last week, the Tribal Council of the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs voted to move forward with plans to close Kaneda, the Central Oregon resort owned and operated by the tribe since 1964. The resort is on part of the Warm Springs Reservation, 70 miles north of Bend, and has long been a favorite vacation destination for Oregonians. Since the relocation of the resort's casino to a spot on Highway 26, renamed the Indian Head Casino, Kaneda has had trouble bringing in enough revenue. The board of directors looked at other financial possibilities, such as fishing tours, guided hunting, and commercial filming on nearby Mount Jefferson. However, the tribal council chose not to take any of those options. The closure means layoffs for 146 workers employed at the spa, restaurant, and hotel, along with administration.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture. On today's episode, Minneapolis officials and Native leaders plan to help people living in tents, and an Alaska Native artist talks about his work in multiple mediums.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Minneapolis leaders and members of the American Indian community are working together to close a tent area being occupied by people who are currently homeless. An estimated 100 people or more, mostly Native American, are living in tents in South Minneapolis, the Star Tribune reports. During a press conference last week, officials said they'll work with groups serving the Native community to help people find housing and assist them with other services. Those camped out say they're struggling to find housing and feel safer living in a large group there than on the streets or shelters. Officials are concerned about the health and safety of the encampment and hope to close it by the end of September. Leaders say they'll also seek long-term solutions to address affordable housing. The St. Regis Mohawk Tribe's police department is closer to becoming an accredited law enforcement agency in New York. New York's governor recently signed a bill which paves the way for the St. Regis Mohawk Tribal Police Department to be accredited. The tribe says it would enhance the agency and promote training and public confidence in law enforcement. Under the new law, the tribal police can apply for state accreditation. The Associated Press reports the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe intends to use money donated to the tribe by professional basketball player Kyrie Irving for youth programs and substance abuse prevention. The Celtic star recently traveled to North Dakota, where he was welcomed home and given a Lakota name. His late mother was adopted out of the tribe, and Irving has embraced his native heritage. He reportedly donated more than $100,000 to the tribe to help support youth. An Alaska Native artist who works in multimediums is making a name for himself in the indigenous art world. His work was recently featured in the Southwest. KCAW's Emily Kwong recently visited with the artist at his studio in Sitka and tells us more.
I am working on some silver jewelry right now.
At his workshop in Sitka, all of Nicholas Galanin's attention is on a thin and shining piece of silver. He brings a pneumatic hand engraver to the metal, moving slowly.
Build it as I go.
And pretty soon,
there's an eye.
The newly born eye of a raven looks back at us.
People don't celebrate the king anymore.
Galanin is a musician too, releasing an album last year with his band, Indian Agent. This is their song, Life Keeps on Spinning. 2018 has been a busy year for Galanin, but a lifetime in the making. In addition to the solo retrospective at the Heard Museum, Galanin released a 140-page monograph and led the carving of a totem pole. Even when working with traditional materials, Galanin has a call and response relationship with history. He tracks on the ways that Indigenous people have been and are displaced, or Indigenous cultures appropriated and commodified. And his work calls attention to that, boldly challenging the viewer and asking him or her, where do you stand?
They're tools. The work is doing work.
Dear Listener is the name of the exhibit, and Galanin's fully aware some of his most attentive listeners are his three children. They've seen the home studio in Sitka grow over the years.
Forever, like, holding new things and new objects, and every object has a conversation, and these conversations we're having now, I have with them.
And that is the most important part for Galanin. Not the art in the exhibit, but the conversations that come out of those willing to take the time, look, and listen. For National Native News, I'm Emily Kwong.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Thank you.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with local activists Philip James and Andrew Tolman about deaf accessibility at the Occupy ICE camp. At 6, it's Trans-Positive PDX. Then at 7, it's Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 56 degrees. Tomorrow it will be partly cloudy with a high of 90 degrees. Today in history, in 1951, a speech by President Truman was the first television program broadcast from coast to coast in the United States. The broadcast was shown by 87 stations in 47 cities. The quote of the day is from primatologist and anthropologist Jane Goodall, who said, quote, "What you do makes a difference, and you have to decide what kind of difference you want to make."
And now it's time for Labor History in Two with host Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1875. That was the day anti-black violence erupted into a two-day massacre in Clinton, Mississippi. As many as 2,500 black Republicans and their families met at Moss Hill, a former plantation destroyed during the Civil War. The day was one of festivities and political speeches ahead of the fall elections. The county Republican Party invited local Democrats to debate. The Democratic state senatorial candidate did address the crowd. The editor of a local Republican newspaper and union officer, Captain H.T. Fisher, followed him. Soon, a group of white Democrats began to heckle Fisher as he spoke. Republican politicians attempted to quell the growing tensions. Almost immediately, however, the heckling whites opened fire on the crowd. Women and children fled in all directions as black Republican forces rushed to defend themselves and their families. By the end of the day, 3 whites and 5 blacks were killed. Clinton's mayor fed off rumors of black retaliation. He called upon white paramilitary forces, the White Liners, from surrounding areas for assistance. Several hundred answered the call and filled the town's streets. Historian Melissa Janczewski-Jones notes that though heavily armed, the White Liners accompanied white locals as they rampaged door to door looking for black Republicans to murder. After 2 days, as many as 50 black Clintonians were killed by white Democrats looking to end Reconstruction and regain political control of Mississippi. A Senate committee would later conclude, quote, "The riots at Clinton were part of a special purpose on the part of the Democrats to break up the meetings of Republicans and inaugurate an era of terror, not only in those communities, but throughout the state." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Food banks in Oregon have been serving people affected by the summer wildfires. I had this story in collaboration with Eric Tegethoff of the Oregon News Service. A food bank is helping people in fire-ravaged areas of eastern Oregon. The Columbia Gorge Food Bank is serving the Dalles and rural Wasco, Hood River, and Sherman counties, where thousands of acres have burned and continue to burn in wildfires this summer, displacing people in the region. Sharon Thornberry is managing the food bank. She says her organization was providing food and snacks to the Salvation Army, which was working on the front lines of fighting fires, and that local communities have largely taken over in this role. She says the Columbia Gorge Food Bank is now looking at long-term aid.
Our focus this fall is making sure that we get food to people as they get back on their feet, as they figure out what they need following the fires.
Thornberry says these rural counties are underserved, whether fires are active or not. The Columbia Gorge Food Bank opened a pantry in June in Rufus, a town of less than 300 people on the Columbia River, and is serving nearly as many people as their pantry in the Dalles. The food bank has been distributing produce and water monthly to Celilo Village, a Native American community in Wasco County that has been affected by wildfires as well. Thornberry says it's crucial to get food to people who have been affected by natural disasters.
You need to be able to meet your basic needs. You need to not have to worry about that. And that's the reason that it's important that we have food pantries available with high quality fresh food for people and the resources that people need, and that they feel welcome at those food pantries and it's in their own communities.
Thornberry notes that one of the challenges for rural pantries is getting enough food and financial donations, and that they often rely on support from outside the region. This is Yasmin Kovanoglu in collaboration with Eric Tegethoff of the Oregon News Service.
Oregon's 1st Congressional District encompasses most of the northwest corner of Oregon, including Clatsop, Columbia, Washington, and Yamhill counties, and a large portion of Portland west of the Willamette River. The district has been represented in Washington, D.C. by Susan Bonamici since 2012. In September, Bonamici is holding 6 town hall meetings in the district to hear from constituents. The first will be in Seaside on Saturday the 15th, and the last in northwest Portland on Monday the 24th. In between, she'll hold town halls in Tualatin, Newburgh, Banks, and Scappoose. Her full schedule can be found on bonamici.house.gov. That's bonamici.house.gov. In a press release, Bonamici says she looks forward to talking with constituents about the issues she has heard about the most, including, quote, health care, protecting the environment, immigration, and holding the Trump administration accountable, end quote. Members of her staff will also be available to assist anyone experiencing problems with federal agencies like the Veterans Administration, Social Security, or the IRS.
According to the Clark County Sheriff's Office, a sheriff's deputy and a civilian were injured during an incident near Hazeldale, Washington, in which the deputy fired his gun. As reported in the Columbia newspaper, the incident began when dispatch received a call about a hit and run. Deputies were then sent to the 9700 block of Tenney Creek Drive in Hazeldale North. As is typically the case in the aftermath of police shootings, the details are hazy and entirely within the hands of law enforcement. We do not know that the vehicle fled from responding deputies. We do know that the vehicle fled from responding deputies, and the chase ended when the civilian crashed. Further details released today indicate that the civilian's injuries were due to the crash as well as being bitten by a police dog. The civilian remains in the hospital. One of the involved deputies was treated and released, and the dog was evaluated as well, but is apparently unaffected. The nature of the shots fired is unclear. We do not know how many were fired, why they were fired, or where the bullets wound up. The deputy is not named at this time, but has been put on paid administrative leave.
Up next is Black History 365. Our friends from KPFT Houston celebrates Black achievements and honors moments in Black history for each day of the year.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is September 4th. On this day in 1910, African-American dancer, choreographer, author, educator, and social activist Catherine Dunham was invited by the New York Metropolitan Opera to stage dances for the production of Aida with soprano Leontine Price. Known for her many innovations, Dunham developed a dance pedagogy that became the internationally acclaimed Dunham Technique.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365, BAM 365, where you find every day Black history is made.
Like many, if not all of us, Jim Hightower took a break from his exhausting commentary schedule yesterday to celebrate Labor Day. Now, in the cold light of the Tuesday after, Hightower has these thoughts on our yearly celebration of working folks.
Workers of America, rejoice! As our nation celebrates Labor Day with backyard cookouts, fun at the beach, or simply kicking back in a lazy boy and doing several rounds of 12-ounce elbow bends, we can all take comfort in the happy news that our economy is whizzing. Economists tell us that job creation is surging, wages are rising, and consumers are racking up record levels of purchases. What's not to like about all that? Two things. First, the economists' claim about wage growth is a sham, covering up the shame that top corporate executives and major shareholders are grabbing nearly all of the economic gains produced by America's entire workforce. The so-called nominal wage, i.e. the sum that workers see on their paychecks, has risen only 2.7% in the past year, a very mediocre result for the 82% of the labor force who are non-managerial worker bees. Second, that nominal wage is not the worker's real wage, for it doesn't take into account the very real fact that consumer price increases eat up the buying power of people's paychecks. Indeed, while nominal wages are up 2.7% in recent months, the price of everything from gasoline to groceries is up by 2.9%, effectively slapping working families with a wage cut. Sure, the economy is whizzing on the working class. This is Jim Hightower saying, so all the rejoicing on this Labor Day is coming from the gated zip codes of the rich. For example, in the same year that workers took a pay cut, the CEOs of America's 350 largest corporations had an 18% jump in their pay, hauling in an average of $18.9 million each. In a lifetime of labor, the typical American worker would not be paid as much as those honchos took in 1 year. Those few are getting rich enough to air-condition hell, and I think they'd better be pooling their money for that project.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now for a lighter, if nostalgic, item in the news. According to U.S. authorities, a pair of ruby slippers worn by Judy Garland in the 1939 Wizard of Oz has been found after 13 years. The shoes were stolen from a Grand Rapids, Minnesota museum in 2005. The thief broke the glass display case and grabbed the shoes. No fingerprints were left behind, and the surveillance cameras were not working that night. Authorities will reveal details of the shoes' recovery later this week. Along with the recovered pair, there are three other pairs of ruby slippers that Garland wore on the film.
It's time for your weekly word puzzle. From KPOV Bend, it's the Point Puzzle with Pearl Stark.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I asked you to start with an instrument of measurement and the unit that it measures. Take each unique letter from the two words, rearrange the letters, and you get a fire month. Well, the answer is thermometer and Fahrenheit. Our winner this week is Ryan Williams, who listens to KPOV in Bend, Oregon.
Could make you want to stay awake at night.
For this week, I've got a back-to-school puzzle. Start with something that you might be buying for art supplies in four letters. Move every letter back 11 in the alphabet, wrapping if necessary, and you will have an art technique. So again, start with an art supply in four letters. Move every letter back 11 in the alphabet, wrapping if necessary, and you will now have a way to make art. When you know the answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday.
Fall is here, hear the yell, back to school, ring the bell, brand new shoes, walking blues, climb the fence, books and pens. I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of September 3rd. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV High Desert Community Radio.
The Senate began confirmation hearings for Judge Brett Kavanaugh's appointment to the Supreme Court. KBOO's Al Kahn has some thoughts on the matter.
Today, the United States Senate begin confirmation hearings for Judge Brett Kavanaugh to become the next Supreme Court Justice for the United States. Judge Kavanaugh has already come out stating that the president should be shielded from any criminal prosecution while in office. Judge Kavanaugh has also come out stating a desire to overturn the Roe v. Wade decision. Make no mistake, if this man is confirmed, our country is in deep trouble, extremely deep trouble. His confirmation will load the court so far to the right that there will be no looking back. There will be no overturn of Citizens United. However, Roe v. Wade will be overturned. This is a disaster. Without safe and legal abortion, women in this country will die. They will die by the hundreds. Throughout history, women have ended unwanted pregnancies, whether by herbal extracts in the Dark Ages, or illegal doctors, or various other forms of self-abortion. All of these can be disastrous. Look around you. Look at your mothers, your daughters, your sisters, your aunts, your friends, your colleagues. Any of these women, any of them, could die. Make no mistake, this is one of the most important Supreme Court nominees of our lifetimes. Trump didn't nominate him just as a whim. Trump looked for somebody that would protect him, and he sees this in Judge Kavanaugh. Kavanaugh would hold Trump above the law, making him immune to the Mueller investigation, which has already pretty much found him as an unindicted co-conspirator. This nomination must be stopped. It must be. Call your congressman. Call your senators. Speak out. I'm Al Kahn, and I thank you for your attention.
The Spanish Defense Ministry has begun a process to halt the sale of 400 laser-guided missiles to Saudi Arabia due to concerns that they may be used against civilians. The process will cancel a contract signed in 2015 and will require Spain to pay back $10 million that they had already received from the Saudis. According to a statement made by the ministry last month, Spain has never sold munitions that could be used against civilians. They also condemned the killing of Yemeni noncombatants. The Saudi coalition has been under attack by human rights groups who have denounced arms sales by the United States and the United Kingdom to Saudi Arabia. They have also called for restraint in bombing campaigns following an attack which hit a school bus last month, killing 51 people, including 40 children. The war in Yemen is now one of the world's darkest humanitarian crises, with more than 22 million people in need of food, clean water, and health care.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, September 4th, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sam Bowman, Yasmin Kobanoglu, Al Kahn, and Teresa Mitchell. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Sam Bowman. The interim directors of Evening News and Public Affairs are Sam Bowman and Teresa Mitchell. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland. At 9, on Political Perspectives, Lisa Loving talks to members of New Avenues for Youth's PAVE program, helping homeless and at-risk youth find skills and employment in the metro area. At 9:30, The Politics of Living explores what makes us happy and how to pay attention to our internal programming. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Bike Show brings you news and views of cycling in Oregon and beyond. All of these KABU programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kabu.fm and click on Donate. Thank you.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Local activists Philip James and Andrew Tolman came into KBOO today to discuss deaf accessibility at the Occupy ICE camp. The speakers you will hear are those of Andrew, who voices both his own and Philip's end of the conversation, as interviewed by KBOO's Teresa Mitchell.
Philip and Andrew are here to talk about the experience of accessibility at Occupy ICE.
Andrew will be interpreting for all of us, not just me.
You were both at the Occupy ICE camp, the successful and internationally famous occupation at 4310 Southwest McAdam, which expelled, for a brief time, the staff there at the ICE detention facility, or the dungeon as it is known locally. And you encountered your own struggle there in terms of accessibility of deaf people. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is Philip speaking. I did decide to join the Occupy ICE movement from the first day. I was a supporter from day one. That support itself came from what I saw of the actions of separating families, detaining children, babies, infants, the abuse, the suffering there. I don't endorse any sort of violence by any means, but I just wanted to join a movement. And I know that Occupy was huge. And in the first few days, there was no interpreters, no accessibility. And I noticed that camp had different tents for different groups, such as the kitchen, safety, accessibility. They were all working in collaboration to try and make sure that everything at camp was running smoothly. The accessibility camp realized upon my arrival that there was no ASL interpreters, and so they immediately were willing to coordinate that. Of course, I understood that budgetary issues would normally prevent that, but I wanted to put money aside. I knew that there were people who were willing to come and support and also interpret. So we wanted to figure out a way to find an interpreter who was willing to come down to camp, maybe a few people even who could rotate through for the remainder of the occupation. So that happened right at the beginning. And so the reason that I actually, wanted to make sure that that happened at camp was not only just for accessibility, but also so that deaf people and hard of hearing people can feel connected to the communities and that they're in, through the occupations, through the activism that happens here, especially in Portland, trying to start that and set that up. And so Andrew was involved in that too, and can probably speak to that.
Voice of Andrew interpreting for Philip. And Andrew, you were also at the camp from the beginning?
I was not there from the very beginning, but a few days later, I noticed the call out on Facebook and responded. I showed up on, I think, maybe day four or so, and tried to remain there for the remainder of the occupation. There are a few days that I myself missed because of work conflicts or otherwise, but I did also coordinate a team of other amazing community interpreters that were also willing to give up their time, use their skill to provide accessibility at camp as well. So we had about 8 or 9 of us that rotated through for the entire occupation up until the last few days. Right before camp was officially swept, we moved our interpreters over into other events and other more local involvements as the occupation extended outside of just the camp and the area near the building. We moved our interpreters as well with the movement to keep all of those branches as they were going out accessible as well.
I had heard something about that, but very little. And so it's an encouraging thing, I think, to hear about this egalitarian nature being spread further than the hearing community. And I'd like to know more about your experience, Philip.
This is Philip. Thank you. I've been involved in a number of activist opportunities with Black Lives Matter, Me Too, March for Our Lives, all of the recent protests that have happened. In the past few years, I've been involved. And through those experiences, most of the time, I feel like I'm involved, that I understand what's going on. But I think that something like Occupy can be scary, because without accessibility, if there's a moment where I'm confronted by an officer, it could easily escalate because of communication barriers. And so that was a big concern for me in terms of public safety and a lack of accessibility. So when it came to Occupy ICE, it was inspiring. Obviously still scary because the experience of having officers with, you know, weapons right in your face, the tension and the escalation between us and the DHS officers that were there, trying to navigate all of the dynamics and the emotions, this was just something that I've never really seen. But the I have to say, the round-the-clock, 24-hour support and work within the camp was incredible. There was no violence. There was nothing that escalated it to the point where I felt scared to be there. It was a beautiful thing to see. It was powerful. You know, other occupations and other movements do have moments where, you know, things can escalate into violence or into, you know, something extreme, but I don't feel like any of those dynamics happened within the camp.
And yet, I imagine it would be fraught with the armed officers there. Of course, there is the famous case of a Mr. Mejia Pote being slain by Portland police only a few years ago, and a great part of that that conflict was simply the fact that he was unable to understand the instructions and the commands being shouted at him from start to finish.
Exactly. And of course, other than the political environment within the country itself, I think that as much accessibility that can be given to politics and activism as possible encourages the deaf and hard of hearing community to be part of the progressive fight for change, to be part of the movement that's happening now. As we see, you know, communities coming together in collaboration, we want to make sure that there's accessibility for all of those communities, all people within those communities, no matter deaf, hard of hearing, disabled, that they have all kinds of accessibility to be involved in that.
I'm really honored that you would take the effort to come in, Philip and Andrew, to express this to KBOO. And it happens, actually, we are now entering the second week of having a text service for the news online, and we hope to expand accessibility in that way. For me, my first reaction to the idea of deaf accessibility to radio was to scoff at the notion, but the more I get into it, the more I see that it's absolutely necessary. So good synchronicity that you two come in today.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for having both of us here. It's really an honor and a privilege to be able to share a voice and a perspective about this and, you know, really get to the heart of the issue of what's happening in Portland and around the country. Things are getting better. We're hoping that Portland is going to continue to be an example of that and inspire other communities to do the same. And I'm really looking forward to that kind of change. Yeah, and this is Andrew speaking as well. I think that it's really important. I think that it's important for any interpreter, any translator, anyone with a specific skill set to be analyzing how we can fit within the movement, because I think everyone has a role, and it doesn't always mean that you are the person in the camp. Maybe you're off-site making other events accessible. Maybe you're talking about it. Maybe you're involving your deaf and hard of hearing friends in the dialogue about it and sharing what you hear on the radio because it's not always accessible. What you see on the TV news, which isn't always accessible. You know, we had times even at camp where Portland News would show up to interview people, and we would request that they allow the interpreter be on the screen while they recorded, and they would crop us out and leave the interpreter out of the shot on purpose after we had already asked for the accessibility and reminded them that captioning isn't always enough. Some people prefer both. Some people prefer just the interpreter. And it's not always for deaf people. It's people who maybe are learning English. If your captions aren't correct, then that's a disservice. If you're not thinking about every intersection of your community, then you're not fighting for all of it. With Black Lives Matter, with Me Too, with Occupy, with all of these movements, we want to see accessibility and equity and interpreters and translators. And if you're going to camp, you know, think about how people with physical or mobility issues can be there. And if not, make sure that you're setting up resources for them to be involved where and how they can, and not making people feel like they have to, like I said, be on site, but just that they can feel involved however they can, and making sure that that information is shared. You know, pursue deaf and hard of hearing or disability groups on Facebook, on Twitter, social justice people who are already doing this kind of work within the deaf and hard of hearing communities. You know, that's the reason that I was even there. It was an honor for me to get to interpret for everyone who was there, people who have been involved in Occupy from the beginning, people who were at Standing Rock, people who have worked internationally, both, you know, deaf and hearing people I'm speaking of, from all intersections of identity. And it was incredibly moving for me to be able to channel that energy and see real communication happen in something meaningful. And I think that, you know, there's a way to encourage all interpreters and all people in any sort of gatekeeping or privileged opportunity to see how we can really be using it, not for us and unselfishly, but for the people who have already been doing that work for generations. One statement that they said on camp was that it was an unbroken chain of resistance. And I think that that's an important perspective to have, that we are not starting this fight. We're just picking it up where we are right now and finding new ways to provide new avenues for that fight to keep pushing forward. Yeah, this is Philip speaking. One thing that I really wanted to emphasize as well, other than supporting just the movement, I think that it's important that we really educate ourselves on the issues. You know, when we have accessibility, then all communities have the ability to educate themselves. So me as, you know, a deaf person, I know that when I'm there, people can see that I'm there. If I'm live streaming, you know, Facebook Live doesn't have captions, so I'll be signing the information, things that I see, things that I am aware of, so that the deaf community in their language from a deaf person that they know can get the information that they need. So I think that providing that kind of accessible information and having that at all times is very important.
Thank you. I'm reminded of what in the 1960s was called solidarity, and these days is called intersectionality, something so powerful that the powers that be are really quite frightened of it. I'm thinking of Judy Berry, who got bombed by an FBI stooge shortly after she put the mill workers and the timber struggle together to fight for the preservation of the forest. It's defeating that dominant culture which centers around whiteness but includes so many other forms of exclusion rather than merely along race lines. And it's fascinating that you two have come in to expand the power of the camp and to break that barrier.
Yeah, this is Philip speaking. You know, we have, I could list any number of marginalized groups, but I think that, you know, we don't always have accessibility. And at camp, you know, we didn't have 100% accessibility, but I think that we tried our very best to include as many people as possible. And I think that, you know, there's always going to be a communication barrier. There's always going to be some piece of accessibility missing when you're kind of working on the fly and when you're in the middle of a fight, when you're doing a lot of things. I think that number one, though, that double and triple layered barrier of communication access is what should be focused on first. Finding ways to really effectively communicate with your community so that you can make sure that people are involved. And this is just a public safety concern. When things aren't accessible, then things aren't safe, and then it's an increased risk for people. Yeah, people, I just really want to raise awareness. I really want to raise voices. I really want to spread out the message to as many people as possible. You know, now is the time for that.
Thank you. And for you both, was there a burning issue in your mind when you came in through the doors at KBOO that we haven't addressed yet?
Philip says, I'll probably turn that to Andrew first while I'm thinking of an answer. Yeah, this is Andrew. I think I just wanted to let people know that accessibility is possible. When we see all of you out there fighting, occupying, winning, making progress, we in Portland in the interpreting, hearing, deaf, signing, hard of hearing, deaf, blind communities are here with you. And we're making the fight accessible here in Portland. And we hope that that will spread into all of your, into your cities as well, because it will increase your power. It will increase your visibility. It will increase our solidarity, our camaraderie. And it will really spread out the message more than you think. I think that you'll be surprised at how much power can really be drawn from just simple accessibility. Captioning videos, bringing interpreters. When you have events going on in your city, contact agencies. Let them know what's going on. I'm sure that there are interpreters on their list. You know, they have lists and lists and lists of interpreters. I'm sure at least one person is willing to be out there to make it happen. We have allies in every community, so I just encourage you all to actively seek them. Like I said before, find them on social media. Don't wait for the deaf people to tell you how to do it. Go and find them. Go and say, hey, how can I help you be involved? Don't wait. Go be active. Show that you want that involvement. I think that that's, you know, number one, and I really just appreciate the opportunity to get to talk about that and get that message out to people and encourage them to reignite this fire, because the fight is not over. We have a long way to go, and now is the time to vamp things up and make it accessible for people who have been waiting to put their energy to something like this. This is Philip. One thing I'd love to emphasize is the message of accessibility being provided. Not only that we have accessibility to the vigils or to the small events, but you know, at Occupy we had almost all day and almost all night accessibility, where we could go and talk to people from different organizations, different walks of life, different ideas, different backgrounds, and engage with them. That kind of opportunity was incredible. When we had a team of interpreters who were willing to rotate themselves throughout the day to make something like that happen, it's a beautiful example of what it could and should be.
For KBOO Portland, I'm Teresa Mitchell.
In celebration of our 50th anniversary, KBOO is teaming up with the Mississippi Records Music and Film Series. KBOO will be hosting Coal Miner's Daughter on Wednesday, September 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. This film from 1980 chronicles the life of country singer Loretta Lynn. Sissy Spacek brings sincerity and depth to her portrait of Loretta and does her own singing in the movie, as does Beverly D'Angelo in the role of Patsy Cline. Tommy Lee Jones also delivers one of his best performances. Again, that's Coal Miner's Daughter on Wednesday, September 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, I was born to coal miner's daughter.
Have you wondered what volunteering at KBOO is like? Do you want to get more involved with your community radio station? KBOO's Fall Membership Drive begins Thursday, September 6th, and runs through Saturday, September 22nd. We need volunteers to answer the phone lines throughout the drive. You can make a huge difference with your participation, helping listeners become members. It's a great way to support KBOO while getting a behind-the-scenes view of how we work at our busiest time. Email Ani at volunteer@kboo.org or call 503-231-8032, extension 213, to find shifts that work for your schedule. Thank you for supporting KBOO Portland.